significant beings, first seeing them as having been our parents in previous lives and having been kind for that reason, and then automatically the wish to repay their kindness surfaces in our mind because we see them as worthy of affection or lovable. Okay. Then there's another way of developing this mind in accordance with the meditation on equalizing and exchanging self and others. And here we focus on the kindness of sentient beings in terms of all of us being the same. Okay? So we actually start out contemplating that all of us are the same in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. You know, that there's absolutely no difference between us. We may have different things that make us happy. There may be different things that we suffer from right now. But in terms of that wish to be happy and to be free of suffering, we're all the same. So they give the example in the scriptures that there might be 10 beggars. They all want to be happy, but you know, one of them likes peanuts and another one likes spaghetti and another one, you know, wants something else. So they have different things that make them happy, but they all want to be happy. Or there might be 10 people in the hospital and they're all suffering and want to be free of that suffering, but one suffering from kidney disease and another from AIDS and another from cancer or something. Okay? So, but we're all the same in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. And I think, you know, we all know that already at some level. I mean, even from the Declaration of Independence, you know, that needs to be rewritten as all people are created equal. That, you know, all people, well, we are created. Interesting how, you know, Christian viewpoint even, yeah, influences that. But, you know, we're all equal. And including bugs and insects and animals, yeah, wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. So we have that kind of idea intellectually in our culture, but we don't really, so it's up here somewhere in our head, but it's not really in our heart. Because the way we live our life on a day-to-day basis is we all want to be happy and avoid suffering, but I'm most important. Yeah? And my happiness is the most important, and my suffering hurts more than anybody else's. Yeah? And after that is the happiness of the people I care about, because I want them to be happy because they make me feel good. And, you know, and their suffering hurts more because when they're miserable, I'm miserable. Yeah. So, you know, we don't really live out any kind of feeling of equality in our life because there's always this big I in the middle of it. Yeah. And saying I'm more most important and everything I think is right and all my ideas are the way things, the way people should do things, and my happiness is more important than anybody else's. My suffering hurts more. I am more deserving of happiness than other people. Why? Because I'm me. That's the logic behind it, isn't it? Yeah. If happiness is to be had, I'm the one who's supposed to have it. Why? Because I'm me. Completely logical and reasonable, right? But that's the way we think. Yeah, I'm miserable. My suffering should be gotten rid of, even if it's a tiny suffering. Other people's suffering, even if it's much greater, can wait. Why? This is my suffering need to be removed right now because it's mine. It's the only reason. No other reason besides labeling it mine. You know, as soon as we label something mine, it becomes much more important than anything else in the whole universe. Okay? So this meditation is helping us to get beyond that and see that we're all the same in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so this is a very important meditation to do, not just to leave it at the intellectual level, because if we really go into this meditation deeply, then it helps us very much with this feeling of being alienated or not fitting in, you know, which we've all felt at some time or another, haven't we? Mm-hmm. I don't fit in, I can't relate to other people. If we, you know, really meditate strongly on this, we'll see that actually we're very close to others, that we understand something very important about them, which is they want to be happy just like we do. And we understand another thing that's very important about them, which is they want to be free of suffering as intensely as we do. And once we know that about somebody else, then, you know, that's the main thing that we get linked together with, because that feeling is so powerful in both of us. So how can we feel alienated and estranged, like we don't understand that person or they don't understand us? Because there's actually something that's, you know, very strong in there. Okay? So, you know, we might see people of different political persuasions. And I mentioned at the beginning, I don't understand the macho male mind that, you know. Okay, so on that level, there might be things that we can't understand. Like, how in the world does somebody think like that? But if you scratch beneath the surface, well, clearly the reason is that they think that thinking like that is going to bring them happiness. You know, the way they're framing things, that's going to bring happiness. Yeah, so the countries that, I mean, I could say the countries, not just the businesses, you know, who are polluting the environment, you know, our dear country who now with this, there's a meeting of the group of eight coming up, and we decided that we didn't agree with the environmental agenda of everybody else because we want the right to pollute the world more. Why? Because we're America and we're the superpower. It's the only reason. You know, but the people think like that because they're trying to be happy. Not because they're evil people, but because they have mistaken conceptions that that's going to bring them happiness. Okay, so when you see violence going on in some part of the world, or, you know, or even in your own family or whatever, why are people like that? Because somehow, in all of our ignorance and confusion, we're thinking that that's going to bring happiness. Okay, so when we see that in ourselves and in others, that common trait of wanting happiness and sometimes being tremendously confused about what creates happiness and what creates suffering, that makes us a lot more tolerant and patient and understanding of other people. In other words, we don't agree with what they're thinking or doing, but we see how we can understand how they got there. Because we can all look back on things that we've thought and done in the past and say, my goodness, what in the world was going on in my mind? Can you do that? Yeah? There's some situations in your life where you can go, what in the world was going on in my mind? I was so stupid. You know? Why didn't I understand that? Why didn't I see that? I did these ridiculous things that got me in trouble and made other people really miserable. What in the world did I think I was doing? Okay, we all have that, don't we? Yeah? So when we can look back and have some kind of understanding for that person that we were who did those stupid things, because we understand that that person was trying to be happy and was tremendously confused in the way he or she was approaching it, if we can have that kind of understanding and forgiveness and compassion for ourselves, then let's take that and direct it at the other people, you know, that we see around us, so that instead of criticizing them, you know, that total idiot, blah, 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 we see, wow, this is just a reflection of what similar to what I was doing at that period in my life where I was so confused and so blind and so ignorant of what creates happiness and what creates suffering. Okay, so when we can do that with other people, you know, it, first of all, it prevents us from developing a lot of grudges and hatred. And it really helps us heal from those grudges and hatred because we see that those other people and us are not very different. Hmm? Yeah? So this is something really, really good to spend some time in your meditation on. Okay? And again, when we do it, it doesn't mean that we're saying that negative actions are positive actions. And it doesn't mean that, you know, okay, here's so-and-so who's, you know, embezzling money and stealing from their parents and, you know, going out and buying it on alcohol. We're not saying that that's good behavior and that's okay. And we're so compassionate and forgiving that we're going to give them more money so they don't need to steal it for their booze. You know, that's not wisdom. Okay, that's stupidity on our part. Yeah, we have to look and say, no, what they're doing is harmful to themselves and others, but we don't have to hate them for what they're doing. Okay? So this is really important to be very clear, because if we aren't clear, we become what we call Mickey Mouse bodhisattvas. Okay? Yeah, Mickey Mouse bodhisattvas. Oh, you ran out of heroin, you're going through withdrawal and you're miserable. Oh, what a pity, let me buy you some more. No. You know? Or the wife who's beaten by her husband. Oh dear, you beat me last night and I have a black eye, but I forgive you because I'm so compassionate. No. That's stupidity. Okay. So, you know, we can have a forgiving attitude, but how we act has to be with wisdom. Okay? And we have to be real clear about that in our mind. Otherwise, we really fall to Mickey Mouse bodhisattva. When I lived in France, one time one of our teachers was coming, so we did skits. We prepared Dharma skits. So one of the Dharma skits was Mickey Mouse Bodhisattva. And it was so cute because somebody had the Mickey Mouse hat. You know, we've all had the Mickey Mouse hat, right? You know, with your two baby. So they put on their Mickey Mouse hat and they were Mickey Mouse Bodhisattva working at the Dharma Center, you know, giving away the Dharma Center's funds for the person who, you know, wanted to go out and buy some dope and, you know, just all these things. And we were roaring with laughter because we could see ourselves in there, you know, in all of our confusion, trying to be nice Buddhists, yeah, that we just completely lost our wisdom in the process. Yeah, it was really funny. Anyway, yeah, so just this meditation of wanting, you know, seeing ourselves and everybody else as equal is very, very powerful. So it's good to do when you're in a public place, when you're in an airport, you know, when you're stuck in a traffic jam. Instead of getting impatient, look around and, you know, think all these people want to be happy just like me and they all want to be free of suffering just like me. Yeah. And so, you know, whenever you're in a place with a lot of people, when you're waiting in line, yeah, when you're at a boring meeting, we don't go to boring meetings, do we? Yeah, so you're at work and you're at a boring meeting and, you know, and so you just, you know, look around at all the people and think like this and then you begin to feel close to them and have some understanding for them. Okay. From there, we begin to see that it's very useless to hold grudges. Yeah, we really see that holding grudges is totally useless. And so this goes back to what we were talking about yesterday or the day before, how something happens and then we develop an identity about it, you know, and we throw ourselves a pity party and we get stuck in that. And so here, just really to let that go and see that, you know, holding grudges doesn't do anybody any good. So we might think, oh, I don't hold any grudges. Yeah. There's a lot of things we think about ourselves that when we start to practice Dharma, we realize are wrong. You know, like I used to think, I don't have a problem with anger. Oh boy, was I in for a shock. You know, or I don't hold any grudges. And then we see that we'll remember things in meditation or in ordinary life, things people said or did to us, and we still feel really hurt about them, or we still feel really angry about them. Yeah? Well, what do we call that? That's a grudge, isn't it? We usually don't call it a grudge. We usually call it, they hurt my feelings and I haven't recovered. Okay, that's what we usually label it. Yeah, it's their fault because they hurt my feelings. And yeah. But actually what it is a grudge. Yeah, because we're holding on. Because when our feelings are hurt, there's some animosity there, isn't there? Mm-hmm. Let's not pretend that, oh, they hurt my feelings and I'm dwelling in the midst of having my hurt feelings, but I don't feel any animosity. Yeah, it's like somebody wrote me recently, they're in the middle of this really horrible, ugly divorce. And they wrote me, oh, I really want my partner to be happy, you know? But look what she's doing, you know. She's just doing everything that's jeopardizing her own happiness. And then the whole rest of the email was all this bad speech about her partner. And, you know, I mean, on one hand, I'm saying, oh, I want her to be happy. And then the rest of it was just like, you know. And if I had said, are you angry? You know, the person would say, I'm not angry. You know, look what she's doing. But I'm not angry and I don't have a grudge. So this is the same as us. We hold on to our hurt feelings about something that happened. I'm not angry. I'm not holding a grudge. Yeah. But I'm just kind of nursing all my hurt feelings. When the world didn't behave nicely to me and these people I love betrayed my trust. And nobody ever else has ever been hurt this bad in the whole wide world. It always happens to me that the people I love reject me. Right? Yeah? This is us, isn't it? So we just hold on to it, and you know, somebody comes along and says, oh, you're holding a grudge. I'm not holding a grudge. Look what they did to me. I didn't deserve that. You know, at that moment, what about karma? Yeah? The whole idea of karma out the window. Yeah? I didn't deserve that. I never did anything bad to anybody in my whole life. We kind of revert back to being 5-year-olds, don't we? Yeah, do you guys say things like that? Or think things like that? Sometimes we don't say them unless we're really worked up. But we think things like that, don't we? I never did anything wrong. Why are they treating me like this? I was only loving and compassionate and they're rejecting me yet again. It always happens. You can see I'm very well perfect. I cannot tell you how many boxes of tissue I have used on this story. Well, I think the Kleenex stock has gone up because of me in my late teens and early 20s. You know, boy, was I a mess. Anyway. Yeah. Well, that wasn't the only time I was a mess. I mean, when you have a good story, I let it go. Okay, so, yeah. So, you know, we have all this stuff going on, and then we don't even realize that it's a grudge. Yeah? But it's really good, you know, give it a different label and acknowledge, you know, okay, there's a grudge. There's some hurt feelings there that I haven't let go of, that I'm feeling something bad towards the other person about. Mm-hmm. So my hurt feelings are my responsibility. They're not the other person's responsibility. Okay, they're my responsibility. And then part of our mind says, why are they my responsibility? They made me feel that way. Oh, yeah? Who made us feel that way? We have no choice about how we're ever going to feel. When somebody says something or does something, there's no choice about how to feel. We're complete emotional automatons. We're kind of like that. We're kind of like push-button emotions, you know? Mm-hmm. Say this to me, it's like pushing the button and out comes hurt feelings. Mm-hmm. We're kind of like vending machines. You know, when you put your quarter in, press the button, and out comes something. You know? And that's the way we react towards our emotion. As if, you know, somebody said that, so they press that button. There's no possible thing that I can react, you know. I have to come out with all these horrible emotions. Is that true? Yes! They did that! But, you know, we have to really come back to it. You know, okay, they might have said or done whatever they did, but why did I react to it that way? That's the issue. You know, they said and they did whatever they did. That's their responsibility. What they said and did, that's their responsibility. How I reacted to it doesn't have to be a given. How I react to it is my responsibility. Hmm. So I can either do my usual old trips, yeah, or I can practice the Dharma and see another way to look at the situation. Those are the only two alternatives. There's no third alternative. Okay, I either do my old trips and run the same old video again and again and again, or I practice the Dharma. And so, you know, at some point you begin to get fed up with feeling so miserable and you decide maybe I better practice the Dharma. Maybe this storyline that I've been getting a lot out of is it's time to retire it. Yeah. Okay. Because, you know, because we need to question these things that we're holding on to. Yeah? Well, especially when the mind says, oh, I didn't deserve that. You know? And then that's really easy to do about stuff that happened when we were little. Oh, I didn't deserve that. I was only two or three. Okay. Well, of course, nobody deserves to suffer, whether they're two or three or 200 or 300. You know? It doesn't matter. Deserving to suffer is not the issue. Okay? Having created the cause to experience suffering is the issue. Okay? And if we look at samsara and we look at who we are as a continuum of previous lives, and that, you know, this life isn't just a one-shot thing, Yeah, the consciousness didn't just originate at conception and doesn't end at death, but there were previous lives and there will be future lives, and therefore what we, you know, said, thought, and did in previous lives created the karma and the karmic imprints that influence what we experience this life. Then we see it isn't a question of deserving to suffer or not. It's like, I'm miserable, I created the cause. You know, it's not the same person who we are in this life, maybe, you know, as the person who we were in a previous life, but there's a continuum. Yeah, and so that karmic seed got planted, it came to fruition right now. Yeah, that karmic seed is my responsibility. Yeah, I didn't purify it. Maybe I didn't know the means to purify it. So I didn't have the karma to meet the Dharma. Maybe I had the means to purify it, but I went to bed that night. You know, I didn't do my purification. I didn't do my four opponent powers. Yeah, so the karma didn't get purified. So there it is in my mind stream. It's ripening right now. Yeah, nothing to be angry about. And then what you can do is also say, well, now, what was the origin of this karmic seed that I'm now experiencing the result of? So we may not know exactly what we did in a previous life. Sometimes we can get rough ideas of general kinds of actions. But all of the negative actions we've ever done were done under the influence of self-centeredness. Okay, that's always a guaranteed. Yeah, because we don't create negative actions when we have a mind that's free of ignorance and focused on cherishing others. Okay, so we can say, you know, that negative karma was created by my own self-centeredness. So why am I blaming somebody else? Yeah. So we only tend to think of karma when we get into our vindictive Christian mode. Of somebody's hurting me now, so they're creating negative karma. I hope they roast in hell because of their negative karma in the future. You know, at that moment, we believe in karma. Yeah, but when we look at our own suffering and we have to say, I'm experiencing misery because of the actions I did due to my self-centered thought in the past. At that point, we don't want to believe in karma. You know, it's just more comfortable to sit and feel sorry for ourselves. Yeah. But it's really, I mean, the whole point in the Buddha Dharma is to realize that it's our mind that creates our happiness and suffering. You know, and understanding that, until we really understand that, it's difficult to do real in-depth practice. Yeah. Because as long as we're not taking responsibility for what we're experiencing and for what we're perceiving, you know, as long as we're continuing to think it's from outside, it's their fault, it's an objective world out there that I didn't play any part in creating. As long as we think like that, you know, we might do some Dharma practice, but we're not going to really penetrate. Yeah? So this understanding of karma is so important. It's so important. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And karma, it isn't kind of magic or mystery or anything like that. It's common sense. It's just cause and result. Yeah. Except it's cause and result that's working on more of a mental plane instead of a physical plane of, you know, I paid the money, give me the goods. Yeah. Or I planted the seeds, where's the sunflower? You know. But it's the same kind of dynamic, except working on a different plane, and it happens to go from life to life, so we may not see, you know, directly the links between causes and effects, but they're definitely there. Okay. So all this is to say that when we understand this, and put it this way, the more we familiarize our mind with this, then the easier it is to let go of jealousy and to let go of grudges and to let go of anger. and to let go of all the bad feelings that we kind of cart around with us. Some people, you know, their whole lives, it's like they're walking through the aisles of life with their grocery cart. And, you know, when you're online and it says add to shopping cart. Yeah. So we would pick, oh, this bad experience. Bing, add that to my shopping cart. You know, oh, that bad experience. Bing, I click on that one. Add those bad feelings to my shopping cart. You know, all the times I've been rejected. All the times people haven't appreciated me. All the times life has been unfair and other people have gotten the reward that I deserved. All the times that I got blamed for all the things that were their fault. You know, and we just click on all those things and, you know, add it all to our shopping cart. And we go through life with this huge shopping cart of, you know, bad feelings. And where does that get us? Yeah, well, in this life we're miserable. And then, you know, we just create more bad karma because of holding on to that those bad feelings. This creates the cause for more suffering in the future. Yeah, so... Doesn't work. So this was kind of a revolutionary thought, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. So let's get back to seeing the kindness of others. But you see, before we can see the kindness of others, we have to realize that they aren't the cause of our suffering. Okay, but as long as we get really hooked into this thing of blaming them, it becomes very, very difficult to see their kindness. Okay, so when we see the kindness of others in this other method, we start looking around us at everything we have, everything we know, everything that's available to us, and we see how it all came due to the efforts of other sentient beings. Because we so often feel in our lives, you know, here are these good things as if they just kind of came out of the blue. Yeah, we really take so much for granted. Yeah, much more, I think, we take things for granted than our parents and grandparents' generations did. Yeah, I think they had physically, you know, a much harder life. So they didn't take things for granted as much as we do. But we kind of grew up in, you know, relative luxury. I mean, can you imagine in America, if you don't have a television set, you're under the poverty line. Isn't that amazing? I mean, what constitutes the poverty line in this country versus, let's say, in India? They're just like worlds apart. Worlds apart. In any case, we take so much for granted, and this meditation is very much designed to help us see, to not take things for granted and to realize that all the things that we enjoy have causes. And sure, some of the causes came from our karma, but some of the causes came from the other efforts of other sentient beings. Okay. And I remember when Lama Zopa was teaching this meditation, he was talking about, because he was, in his previous life, he was a meditator in the Solokumbo area of Nepal, and when he was a child in this life, he was born in that area, and so sometimes would be up there. He doesn't go there so much nowadays, but he used to. And the villagers, of course, all have a lot of faith in him. And it's a very poor area. You know, you mostly eat potatoes and sampa and butter and meat. And sometimes rice. Rice was kind of a big thing when you had rice because the climate didn't grow so much rice. It was more potatoes. And so people would come and make offerings to him. And he said that, you know, when he really thought about the kindness of these people, when they offered him even one grain of rice, it became so difficult for him to accept. You know, it was like he felt so unworthy to accept even one grain of rice from them, having seen their incredible kindness. Yeah. And of course he accepted it because that was a way for them to create virtue. Yeah. But he didn't take it as a thing to take for granted. And when we think of it, you know, if we have one grain of rice to eat, how many living beings were involved in that grain of rice? Hmm? Yeah, I mean, who owned the land and who plowed the land and who planted the seeds and who took care of the crop and who reaped it and who separated the rice and the husk and who packaged it and who transported it. But, you know, you can't package it and transport it without other people. You know, who are the people that developed, I mean, all the materials that came into the packaging, all the people that were involved in the materials in which the rice was packaged, all the people who were involved in making the truck that the rice was loaded on to move it to the grocery store. Yeah, so all the miners who got the metal, who, you know, and then the people who did whatever else they have to do with metal to get it into the form so that you can make it into an engine, and, you know, I don't know all these things, you can tell. But, you know, there's a lot of people whose life's energy are put into all of that. And if they hadn't had done that, we wouldn't have that one grain of rice to eat. Okay. So you look at each grain of rice, how many grains of rice are you eating? And how many sentient beings are, you know, their kindness lying behind each grain. And then you get the broccoli and you get the carrots and the cauliflower and the dal and everything else. And it's just incredible how many living beings' life energies are there behind even one meal that we eat. And do we pay attention to that when we eat that meal? Or do we just take it for granted? Oh, of course I have food. Let's eat this fast so I can get more. Yeah? Or are we really considering how many beings' life energies went into that? Hmm? Or even, you know, this room that we sit in right now. I mean, how many beings' life energies went into it? The previous owners, the Unruhs, built it. Yeah? But, and the wood came from the forest. But who cut the wood? And who lugged it in here? And who poured the concrete? Yeah? And who put the logs in the shape that they're in? Yeah. And who put the new metal roof on? We know that. We know those beings kind of. Yeah. But, you know, and all the renovation that happened in this room, because there used to be a dirty, ugly kerosene tank right there, and there used to be garage doors where you're sitting back there, and the whole ceiling was, the roof and ceiling were lower, and, you know, this floor wasn't in here. And so, you know, there was a little bit of electricity, but, you know, who put in the original electricity? Who put in the later electricity? Who put in the floor and the matting under the floor and the paint and, you know, and the lamps? And you start looking in the tankas and the cloth that the books are wrapped in and the bowls and, you know, how many living beings each object in here can trace itself back to. And then we realize how incredibly interconnected we are with all these other living beings in so many other parts of the world even. Yeah? But some, you know, sometimes we just feel, oh, well, it's just with, you know, other people in our country, or it's just with the people we're doing trading with. Yeah. But you know what it made me see is this latest thing, how people in Panama, kids in Panama, had died because of a sweetener in cough syrup that wasn't actually a sweetener but was some chemical but was shipped to Panama but was made in China. You know, now how many of us think of Panama every day? Might be one of those countries we don't think about very often. And yet, then all of a sudden you read this in the newspaper and it's like, those kids in Panama die because of something people in China did. Yeah, and then the shipping companies who transported all this stuff from port to port without ever checking what it really was. Yeah, and then we see, wow, oh my goodness, how interrelated we are. Yeah, and how many, you know, because the cough syrup may have been made in Panama, but the ingredients came from other parts of the world, from probably many different countries. Yeah. So same with things that we use here. Many of them probably came from all over the world. But we don't even realize a lot of that. And yet we're very much connected with the people, many of whom, you know, live in incredible circumstances of poverty, but who, by whose effort we are reaping the benefit right now by having the things that we use. Okay. So spending some time thinking about this, it's a very humbling experience, yeah, of really seeing how interdependent we are and therefore how kind other sentient beings are. Because we often, you know, don't think of that. We have this American individualistic mentality of, you know, everything in my life I'm responsible for, and I pull myself up by my own bootstraps, and I don't need nobody. You know, and actually we need everybody, don't we? And I think more than any other time in history, we are interconnected now and dependent on others. Yeah. Because if you look, maybe 100 or 200 years ago, yeah, the people who lived, they could grow their own food. They found some way to make some clothes. They had some sort of transportation that mostly they were responsible for, even though they definitely depended on their neighbors and relatives and so on. But now we're so dependent on an ever widening group of people. Yeah. Because if we look at our clothes, it isn't just a thing of the wool came from the sheep that our neighbors grew and we spun. It's like the wool came from, you know, some other country, and the spinning machine came from another one, and the people who made the you know, put the wool together and to form the sweater made, and, you know, came from another country, and all these things that are transported. And we see really how dependent we are. And how, you know, I don't know about you, but I'm incapable of growing my own food. Yeah? Yeah? I don't know how to make cotton and spin cotton and weave it into cloth. And yeah, I can often operate a sewing machine a little bit. That's about it. Don't understand anything about electricity except how to turn on the switch and how to call somebody else to help because I don't know what to do. Yeah. Don't understand anything about cars. Yeah. Except how to turn the key and, you know, press the gas and the brake. Yeah. So, you know, if we look, we're very, very dependent on others for things that are very essential in our lives. So it's really helpful to spend some time just thinking about this and doing some research about all the beings who are involved with, you know, our ability to stay alive. And then people say, but they didn't intend to be kind to me. They were only doing this to earn a living. Well, so what? That's not the issue. Yeah. The issue is if they didn't do what they did, we wouldn't have what we have. That's the bottom line. Yeah. The issue isn't whether they thought of me particularly and wanted to grow this cotton just for me because I'm so special. That's not what makes them kind. Yeah. We usually think of kindness in this way, when somebody does something specially for me because I'm special. That's not the definition of kindness, you know. If somebody did something, and without their having done that, I wouldn't have received or reaped the benefit that I reap. That's the bottom line in there. You know? Therefore, we really have to see all these other people as having been kind to us. Yeah? And when you do that, then when somebody cuts you off on the highway, you don't get mad at them. Because this is some kind sentient being whose efforts you've benefited from in some way. Because they didn't, you know, maybe they were the person who works at the public utility board who was responsible for you having electricity. So are you going to honk your horn and, you know, give them the finger when they drive by and they cut you off? They've been kind to you. Yeah, their kindness is much more prominent than cutting you off. I think it's so amazing when people get cut off, they feel like the other person deliberately is trying to harm them. You found that? You know, they cut me off. They're deliberately trying to harm me. Now think about it. Would somebody really do that? Would a stranger really deliberately try and harm you by cutting you off and risking an accident? But even if they're angry, are they deliberately gonna, you know, try and harm you? You've done that?
No, I've had somebody deliberately try and run me off the road, and I have no idea why. And cussing at me through the rolled up window. I didn't have any idea who they were or what they were doing.
Okay. Okay. A couple of exceptions in there. But think of the times, have any of you cut people off when you've been driving? Did you do it deliberately? Were you shocked when all of a sudden there was a horn sounding behind you? Like, who's that guy honking at? And then you realize, oh, I must have cut them off. Yeah? Or maybe you cut the guy off first. So I think most of the time when, you know, we're cut off, people don't mean it. So, in any case, you know, when we really meditate deeply about this kindness that we've experienced, and we see that we've been the amazing recipient of a tremendous amount of kindness in our lives, then that's all you see when you see sentient beings is their kindness. Yeah. When we're self-centered and enveloped in our pity party, then all we see is how others have been mean to us. But when we meditate on kindness, then all we see is kindness around us. Yeah? So we very clearly create our experience and how we perceive the world by, you know, steering our mind towards looking for one thing or looking for another thing. And so I think it's very, very important as part of our mental training to steer the mind so that we see kindness. Yeah, because when we see kindness, our whole mental emotional experience changes, and then automatically we want to be kind in return. Yeah, it doesn't become difficult to be kind. When you see somebody as having been kind to you, returning their kindness comes so easily. And so that's where it leads into love, wanting sentient beings to have happiness and its causes. Because when we see that we've been the recipient of a lot of care and concern and kindness, then we want others to have happiness and its causes too. And when we see everybody as equally having participated in being the cause of our happiness, or having equally participated in bringing about the circumstances in which we experience well-being, then everybody equally we want, you know, to have happiness and its causes. Okay, so that's what love is. And then compassion is wanting them to be free of their suffering, their misery, which I said was the second main thing we have to focus on, which I haven't gotten into yet.